That's nice. Before we start, what kind of recorder is that?
It's an Olympus. And we got a sort of an advanced microphone for it, and the plug it in. It's fantastic. I've done cell phone interviews where I've put my cell phone on speaker, and it's come across just fantastic. And I'll keep an eye on it here. The bars let me know that it's picking up and recording.
Okay.
So I am Laura Hill in Indianapolis with Reverend Marvin Chandler. Today is May 13th, 2009. So we talked about this on the way over, but you are from Indianapolis. You grew up here.
Actually, from Bloomington, Indiana.
Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. My wife and I both grew up in Bloomington.
Okay. And so tell me how you came to Rochester. What brought you there?
Well, I actually went to Rochester to attend seminary.
Okay.
I got my baccalaureate degree at IU, at Indiana University. And had actually been a minister in the Baptist denomination.
Okay.
Which did not necessarily at that time emphasize educational background, but I had some ministers in Bloomington, Caucasian ministers, who felt that the value of a seminary education had some connection to me, so they encouraged me and mm-hmm. supported my going to seminary after I finished undergraduate school.
Okay. And how did you choose Colgate?
Well, the campus minister at Bloomington was an American Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
Colgate Rochester was, of course, the kind of premier American Baptist school. His name was W. Douglas Ray. He sat on the Board of Higher Education for American Baptist Churches and knew the president of Colgate Rochester very well.
Okay.
His name was Wilbur Eddie Saunders.
Mm-hmm.
The very interesting thing was that in those days there was a quota for African Americans in seminaries. And
across the board or at Colgate?
Well, I think it was probably across the board.
Okay.
Certainly there was at Colgate, and I don't think it was any different, although that was a progressive school.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, it was known as a liberal mm-hmm. seminary. And whatever those restrictions might have been, or strictures of, I was admitted
mm-hmm.
into the seminary.
How many other African Americans were there?
Oh, my goodness. Now, that's a good question. There's Obadiah Williamson, Sam Yet. Oh, my. There were probably three or four of us. I don't think there were any more than that at that time.
And that was in the school as a whole or in your incoming class?
Well, that was pretty much in the school. Well, there might have been a couple more. I think there was Wendell Phillips and one other man who was... He'd come back to Colgate Rochester and pursuing his doctorate and was doing some work there. But I think there were a very limited number, actually, of fellows. I would say maybe at the most, even including the upperclassmen, six or eight.
Okay. I'm going to pause this for 1 second. Okay, we're good. So then there's a handful of you, five or six. What
right.
was that experience like for you all?
Well, I don't recall any particular tensions. I think that the academic work was demanding enough that it kept your attention on pretty much. We didn't think much about the socials. Actually, most seminarians, the Caucasian fellows as well, and we had a couple of Asian people there, that it was so demanding that people didn't worry too much about socializing, and so you didn't think about all the things. And besides, I was married, and my wife and children lived in Buffalo. My field work was in Buffalo.
Okay.
So every weekend, I would go back to Buffalo, spend the weekend, and then go back to Rochester during the week. So it was almost a commute.
Oh, sure. I have read some things that were coming out of Colgate Rochester at the time that suggested there was really a push on their part to provide a relevant education for their black students. Do you remember that? Do you recall that?
Well, I think I don't recall that there was any special orientation toward black students in terms of social relevance, but the whole history of Colgate-Rochester Divinity School had this strong Rausenbusch, who was a social theologian, had that strong emphasis. So that we called it the prophetic ministry, and that aspect of ministry was certainly a focus. It was a part of the focus of Colgate-Rochester Divinity School. And predecessors, Howard Thurman, who was great, an eminent African-American, who was widely known around the world. He was a good friend of Gandhi. He was called one of America's 10 greatest preachers. He went to Colgate-Rochester. And at that time, he, I don't want to say suffered, but he endured the kind of racial challenges that anyone would find in northern American cities, which is kind of like a minefield. But and I think nonetheless he had mentors at Colgate-Rochester and friends who inspired him towards his writing. And one of Howard Thurman's, I think one of his most penetrating analysis is in his work called Mysticism and Social Action. And it comes out of his, I think, out of his understandings, part of which were influenced by Rufus Jones, a Quaker, and other people, but the Rausenbusch kind of thought.
How did you come to be involved with Rochester, the city?
While I was in seminary, I was asked or invited to become minister to the migrants in Monroe County, which, of course, Rochester. Some of the those camps, though, were in adjacent counties.
Wayne County.
There were, and see, there was Wayne and the other one toward
Genesee County,
and Orleans. There were 39 migrant camps of varying sizes, and the responsibility of the migrant minister was to somehow try to be in touch with and address some of the situations. The largest camp was at Brockport, New York.
I think it still is.
And a tremendous challenge. The people came up in a very, was really a temporary situation. Some of the camps, the conditions were not too bad, and others they were pretty deplorable. I think the whole system, though, was almost serfdom. There was this, the owner who was kind of sort of like,
A feudal lord.
Landed gentry. And the crew boss, who worked for the landowner, was often the kind of strategic person, sort of the pivotal figure. They used to bring liquor and prostitutes and things, gamblers out to the camps, and it really impoverished people because they would, you know, they'd get drunk, and some of them, and and those who didn't make enough money to really get out of their very vulnerable situation, so that they were almost perpetually indebted. And it was a sad thing. And yet there were many people there who had, you know, religious experience, primarily, I would say, in fundamentalism, one kind or another. But trying to reach that population and serve the spiritual needs of people was a challenge. But part of it was my own inexperience with dealing with people. My wife and I came from the Midwest. We were unprepared to meet with folks who looked very different. I mean, they were very dark-skinned people, beautiful people, but dark-skinned, with big eyes, almost stereotypically, mm-hmm. African. And I'll never forget it, because at first I was pastoring a church in Leroy, New York. It's a little Baptist church, African-American. And those people at that church wanted nothing to do with what they called those bean pickers.
The bean pickers.
Mm-hmm. So the social distance was pretty large. And I felt that when I first went out, I would talk about these people. And I remember one time in late fall, it gets cold there, and I went to one of the places, and there was a lady there who was ill, and her husband, a very large man. They had several children, and they had two rooms, very small rooms. She was ill, and this poor man was sitting on the side of the bed, and he was weeping because he couldn't get any help for his wife. And I sort of vacillated between being profane and trying to be spiritual. Mm-hmm. But I called around, couldn't get anybody. I finally got a doctor, I think he was an Italian doctor, who said he would come, and he came out to the camps and saw this lady, examined her, and got her to a hospital. She got well, actually, eventually. But I was so angry, so mad, and feeling so frustrated and inept and ineffectual. I was so just cussing mad, as they say. On the way home, after everything had settled down and the lady got into the hospital, and I'm driving along, and I've been crying and have all this business by myself, I suddenly realized that I had said to this man, "We need you." And it was the change from "these people need you" to "we need you." And that it was enormous. Because from then on, I felt very comfortable. My wife would go out and sit and talk with the ladies, and they would give us, produce. They couldn't pay us, but they wanted to get it. We took the stuff that they gave us. This was their... And we just felt very much at home after that. Mm-hmm. We loved it. But I'll never forget that, because that was the turning point. I think that you have to feel when you're there. I don't understand preachers who, whatever their denomination, who want people to look up to them. We are servants. We are the servants of the church. I really feel that deeply. Mm-hmm. So that was my experience with social relevance in Rochester, my first year.
You said the church you were at in Leroy, you felt a social distance. Who facilitated your involvement with these migrant camps? Do you recall?
The Council of Churches.
The Council of
the
Churches.
The Rochester
okay,
Area
so
Council of Churches appointed guys each, whenever there was a, an opening, and they felt that it had to be somebody African American, because most of the migrants were African American.
Sure.
And the fellow who preceded me was a wonderful guy. Willie Collins was his name, and generally had been the migrant minister was the minister of the Second Baptist Church of Leroy, which was a little church there. So it sort of fell to each person who came. But the people from Leroy Second Baptist and Mumford Second Baptist were generally people who were a step above in terms of the social ladder. They were the house people, not slaves, but house people, servants, and mm-hmm. So they didn't want anything to do with this.
Maids, chauffeurs,
yeah,
porters.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Exactly. And they had great. The people there in that church, He had great dignity and self, you know, posture. They were very poised people. Very interesting, very needy spiritually. And we loved it. We came to love those people at that church really very, very much. We only spent a year there, but we maintained the relationships way after that. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting experience.
So you start to get involved through the Council of Churches, mm-hmm. with the city.
The migrant ministry.
With the city itself.
And then that, well, my ministry with the migrant ministry or situation gave me a contact with the Council of Churches. And I was in my junior year, I think, at the seminary. And my final year there, board of directors and the director, executive director, Richard Norman Hughes, began to look at me for some position. They wanted to integrate their staff there. You know, the migrant minister was kind of an ancillary position. Mm-hmm. But they wanted someone in their core staff. So when I graduated from Colgate Rochester, I was immediately invited to become an associate executive for the Council of Churches.
I see. And so what year is this?
Oh my, let's see, that would have been 68?
No. That late?
Well, yeah, let's see, No. The riots occurred in 64.
That's 64.
60. 60, it would have been.
Okay.
Because that's the year I graduated.
Okay.
A long time ago.
Okay. And so you have this position now with the Council of Churches.
My position, my portfolio was as Christian Education Director.
Okay.
So I was putting together all these little cut and paste programs for churches, young people, and Vacation Bible School, and that kind of thing. Continuing religious ed and weekday religious education classes. That was the first year. And it wasn't long after that the riots occurred.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. But I am interested in the time in between, in 60 to 64.
Okay.
How would you characterize what was happening in Rochester? How do you remember those years? Because there's a ton of stuff happening.
Oh, yeah. Well, my recollection centered more around the churches. And there was no way that an American city the size of Rochester could ignore what was going on around. It was in those days that the civil rights movement was occurring in America. Mm-hmm. And I think poverty, the discrimination in Rochester was not so obvious, but it was there. Mm-hmm. And the problems of poverty and displacement were beginning to, you know, come into the purview of the churches, and they began to look and say, what can we do, not just about migrants out there, but what can we do to move toward more contact, cross-contact with African-American churches and so forth. So there was this effort, I think, during those years in the churches to at least not so much integrate as to have some kind of interconnection. In the industries and the businesses of Rochester, I don't recall any particular dynamic that was taking place that would be striking, but the civil rights movement in general was beginning to affect all kinds of things. The young people, the kids in the high schools, mm-hmm. Charles Price and I, and there was a woman, a social worker, I think she was in the school system, Effie Williams. I think her name was Effie. I think Williams was her last name. Portia's, because she's a friend of Portia's. You can check that out. But anyway, she and Chuck and I used to meet each other constantly downtown. We would be down there trying to... The kids were getting pretty feisty, and they would have these fights and on the streets. Mm-hmm. And we were trying to keep them from getting into trouble with each other. And Charles was a community liaison, and he was meeting with groups and families and these kids trying to help do that. And I was trying to help on behalf of the churches, because we could see all of this kind of unsettling dynamic that was taking place in communities. The whole thing was going across the country, and Rochester was not exempt from that.
Mm-hmm. There's also, there is either an actual increase or more visibility of police brutality and harassment.
Yeah.
What do you recall about that in Rochester at that time?
I would hear from time to time that some things had occurred, and there was not a cordial relationship between the African-American community and the police in Rochester, generally speaking. But when we moved into Rochester that year after seminary, my neighbor across the street was the police chief.
Okay.
Bill Lombard.
Lombard, sure.
William Lombard.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a very cordial relationship. I think Bill Lombard tried as much as anyone could to, I think he really did try to make connections in the black community and try to ameliorate some of the things. But some of the cops were pretty brutal. I mean, I remember that there were instances that people talked about of mm-hmm. brutality.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember whether it was, let's see, 1960, because at that time, I believe, across the country, the Black Power Movement hadn't come into prominence yet.
Right.
But there were all kinds of groups around the country trying to do various and sundry things. And very often, because they confronted the establishment, as they said in those days,
mm-hmm.
They would run into the police.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, there were, of course, those situations like family situations, and if there were confrontations in the family, it would explode into something, and the cops would come and people would get beaten up and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall any particular thing at that point.
Mm-hmm. In these years, another dynamic in Rochester, of course, is that Malcolm X is coming in frequently.
Oh, yes.
Tell me about that.
I didn't have much to do with most of that. But I do remember at one time Malcolm came. It was just before he was killed.
Okay, so this is in February of 65.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I believe it was only a few weeks. Gus Newport at that time was a bodyguard for Malcolm X.
Okay.
Malcolm came in and he spoke at Cornhill United Methodist Church.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we knew Gus, and I had a kind of cordial relationship with Gus, and we would laugh and talk about things. But Malcolm was doing his famous speech about the difference between field folks and house folks, and using the N-word and all that stuff. And I used to say, well, how can you be that way? Because, I would be one of those people you're talking about, but I'm trying my best to do it. I remember when Malcolm came in, but I didn't know him. I never did. I think I met him once.
Mm-hmm.
I did meet Minister Farrakhan.
Okay.
And as a matter of fact, I was doing a radio show and interviewed Minister Farrakhan. for my radio show, at his insistence, because I was the only African-American doing radio at that time, and doing the kind of interview kinds of things. And I said to him, well, Minister Farrakhan, the only restriction I would put on interviewing you is one I'm going to put on myself, and that is, I feel that I need to be able to ask you freely to ask you any question. You may not want to answer it, but I feel that I should be able to ask you any question that I feel is appropriate. And he said, oh, yes. Well, I found him to be very articulate, and a wonderful interview. He was a good man.
And this is in Rochester.
In Rochester.
Uh-huh.
For WBBF.
Okay. In these years, you've mentioned some of the problems already, the poverty, the massive migration, the discrimination. What was being done leading up to the riot to alleviate some of these problems? What was being done by churches? What was being done by civil rights groups? What was being done by the city?
I wasn't too much aware of the organizational efforts that were taking place. I know the Urban League was there.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, I think
it comes a little later. I think it's 65 that the Urban League
was there.
Gets underway.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a commission, New York State Commission for Human Rights.
That's right.
And the Baden Street Settlement was one of the focal points for trying to make change. But I remember the Baden Street because they represented the kind of community organization in the classic sense of the word.
Okay.
That these were polite people who would have nice programs, and they would invite people to come in and speak about problems, and then and that's pretty much what got done. So there were these kind of what I call chamber of commerce type programs going on in terms of community relations. In Rochester. I remember a little of that.
Okay.
I don't remember. I think the Fair Housing, whatever that Fair Housing Act.
Commission.
Had some arms and legs in Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
Housing discrimination, I think, probably was still pretty potent, although my wife and I we bought a house in the Browncroft area.
Okay.
And I think the reason that was because I was a council of churches executive.
Sure.
So that the social distance wasn't very far. I think people like Walter Cooper and others were able to buy in integrated neighborhoods. Some of the neighborhoods were becoming integrated.
Mm-hmm.
People like Connie Mitchell and John stayed at that point was essentially the hood.
Right.
And they had their connections there. But that's pretty much the way I remember.
Okay. And so then, tell me about the riot. Where are you? How do you hear about it? What do you do?
Well, let's see. I remember I'd gone to bed, actually. Someone called, I can't remember, I think it might have been St. Julian Simpkins.
Okay.
He was the urban canon for the Episcopal Church in Rochester. And he had just gotten there like 48 hours earlier. And I get this call, I believe it was from St. Julian, I'm not sure, because I didn't even know Franklin at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But he wanted to know what could we do, and I said, well, I'll be right there. So I got up out of the bed, and I got St. Julian, and I met at St. Simon's Church, I think, or someplace. And we go over to where the riots were. And one of the first places we went to was this bar that a fellow named Kenny Stevens, owned. And here's Julian with his Episcopal collar on and me with my shirt and tie. And we go into this bar, and I think it was Kenny or somebody like him, says, what are you doing in here? You know, who do you think you are? And da 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 da. And I said, now wait a minute. And of course, they some of those people called us everything but a child of God. And I'm looking at poor St. Julian. And St. Julian was a great big man.
Okay.
But very Episcopalian.
I'm an Episcopalian. I know all about it.
And here we are up here in this bar. And I said, well, now, wait a minute. We're down here in this place because we want to be. I said, we don't have to be here. Because that's when the guy says, well, you live out there in Browncroft Boulevard. And I said, yeah, I live out there. And I'm down here because I want to be here. And I said, I haven't always lived in a middle-class neighborhood. I said, I grew up in a family of eight and smelled feet the first 6 years of my life because I slept with two other brothers.
Uh-huh.
And we went through all this.
Right.
So they kind of, you know, allowed us then. But we went down and we talked to the police and tried to talk to people to calm them down and that sort of thing. So that's how we happened to be there. And after that, we went to the Council of Churches. I called Dick Hughes, who was the executive of the Council of Churches, and we said, he immediately said, well, what can we do? And I said, well, I don't know yet, but, you know, we need to stay in touch with it. So that became my portfolio, just like that. Boom. I was
liaison.
Suddenly a liaison. Mm-hmm. And the council asked me to, you know, stay in contact. So the next day, I was down in that was the 7th ward. Mm-hmm. And then we went down in the 3rd ward because that stuff broke out there the next day. That's where one man got killed and there was just a whole bunch of stuff. I remember that. It's a confused jumble in my mind, but I remember, and Julian and I were sort of the first church people that we knew anything about that were there. There were street people. Mildred was very much involved trying to help calm people down. Some of the ministers, Murphy Greer, Reverend Jackson, whose church was there, 7th Ward, I remember, Reverend Shankle, and I think, and Franklin was there. These were guys, they were out on the street more than I was at that point, talking to people and trying to get them, you know, kind of calm down a little bit. But the main, the issues that came out of it were, you know, that it this was, folk didn't have jobs, they were poor, there was brutality, and that sort of thing that came out of the it seemed to be the sore points that people were feeling.
Were you surprised?
No, I wasn't really surprised. I felt that, I think people felt that the pot was boiling, that something could happen in Rochester, because there had been incidents of police brutality, there was a lot of poverty and the distance between downtown and and the 3rd and 7th wards. I think anybody looking at it would have said that something could happen. I mean, I didn't know that it was that close to boiling over, but
yeah. What kinds of structures were in place? What kind of structures were in place that you were then able to utilize afterwards, right? And so by this I mean, what were the relationships you were drawing on? What were the networks? How did all of that function?
Well, we had a new urban minister named Herb White.
Yeah.
Herb had connections and had really worked on trying to establish relationships so that some of these people began to emerge.
And this is the Council of Churches. He's working for Council of Churches?
Okay. Right. Mm-hmm. He was the urban minister for the Rochester Area Council of Churches. And Georgiana Sibley, who was then the president of the council, made her home kind of a, what did they call it? It was not headquarters, but it was sort of like a headquarters. Her son was the commissioner, police commissioner. And so it was kind of funny because we were meeting at her house, and And sometimes she was on one side of the issues and her son would be on the other.
I've heard that.
But we met there, and that's where I met Franklin and some of the other guys, because, well, I didn't meet them there. I met them on the streets, but we all met together and began to say, what can we do? When things began to calm down just a little bit. In the middle of the thing, we were just sort of running around, you know, trying to put out fires wherever they were.
Sure.
But what began to emerge from the anger of, and some of the young people whose names I can't remember to this day, but I remember their faces. And they said, man, we need jobs, we need, it's awful, we need this, and that, we need some place for the kids to go, we need da 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 da. So they began to really express the needs of the community. And then we said, well, okay, then how can we respond in an organized fashion to this? So we thought about how can the church be involved? And we realized that white churches, there was no way they could. And most, even black churches, would had some distance from some of these street folks, we called them.
Sure.
So how could we do this? How could we get involved and develop relationships? And we began to think about that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, stop it for 1 second.
Absolutely.
While I run.
So I was asking you about the structures that were in place, and you were saying that you met a bunch of these people, that you really sat down and talked with them at Mrs. Sibley's house.
Right. I think what happened, I was just thinking about this as we took a little break there. Leaders began to emerge from the situation.
Mm-hmm.
There were people who seemed to have groups of people around them. And that's a very important point, I think, in terms of leadership. Because as the fight organization emerged, these leaders became more visible, and your definition of leadership was affected by it. For example, the news media would say, who are the leaders of the black community? And of course, they were thinking about the established things like the churches and the political organizations and even the quasi-political organizations.
Sure.
Well, Minister Florence, the head of the fight organization, had a wonderful way of responding to that. He would say, well, you know, a leader is somebody who has followers, which makes perfectly good sense.
Right.
And it's a good theory of leadership, actually, you know.
Sure.
To be a fundamental. So these people began to emerge, and we then said, okay, how can we do what you want us to do? And one of the ideas that I tried to encourage our board of directors and other people representing the churches was, we can't tell this group of people how to organize whatever it is they want to do.
Right.
And I think what we have to say is, what can we do as churches to assist you? Now that's a different kind of position than churches and institutions are generally. Institutions love to have, you know, their program carefully formulated and their policies, and then you work, you know, you organize around that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in this case, I felt that we had to turn that upside down and say, you know, we can't just have those people fit an institutional pattern. This is the people who are telling us that they want us to do what they want us to do. So,
how did the institutions in Rochester respond to that message?
Not very well on some of them. I think there are a number of churches. I think if really the mainline denominational churches had questions. But it was very interesting. I think they trusted the council as a representative body.
Mm-hmm.
They trusted it enough to say, okay, we'll give it a chance.
So then let's back up a little.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the Council of Churches. What is it? How does it function? Is it affiliated with the National Council of Churches? If so, in what ways?
Yeah. Actually, the local, the Council of Churches movement, the conciliar movement, was pretty much locally based.
Okay.
And representatives of the National Council of Churches did not necessarily come from the local council. Very much, as a matter of fact, the National Council of Churches was more denominationally based, so that the denominations sent representatives.
I see.
To that body.
Okay.
It's an ecumenical body that was representative of most of the major mm-hmm. denominations. The local council of churches, any local congregation of the churches could be a member of the council of churches. Mm-hmm. Their programs were simply cooperative efforts in education, religious education generally, and mission, and they called that the migrant ministry, mm-hmm. and in some instances in foreign ministry, some of the councils did. And then they had social programs, some kinds of family structural things where they tried to strengthen families and that, pretty much. Mm-hmm. But that was pretty much what councils of churches did, and they were organized. I think in Rochester, the council was organized back in around 1915, maybe.
Okay. And does the Rochester Council of Churches have membership from both white and black churches?
They did not at the time.
Okay.
Principally.
Okay.
I think maybe St. Simon's Church, which St. Simon's Episcopal Church.
The Catholic?
Not at that time.
No? Okay.
No. The, as a matter of fact, the Roman Catholics were not a part of the Council of Churches.
Okay.
In those days.
Okay.
That came later. And actually, it was later that we dissolved the Council of Churches as such and became Genesee Ecumenical Ministries.
I see.
And part of the reason was they wanted to include the diocese, the Roman Catholic
sure.
diocese,
mm-hmm.
so that the editor of the diocesan newspaper, Father Henry Atwell, became the Council of Churches executive,
okay.
or the ecumenical
Genesee,
executive,
sure. mm-hmm.
and I became an executive for Black Church Ministries.
Well, okay, so there's also, is it RAM, Rochester?
Area Ministers Conference.
Conference,
yes.
And that is a group of black ministers.
That's right.
Okay,
now
so
they had not been. That group came into existence partly out of the riots because
okay.
they had to organize. And part of my portfolio was to help the ministers to organize.
I see.
And that was, you know, I really went to them saying, the churches want to help. And if you're organizing, whatever I can do to bring the strengths of the council, which money and people and whatever else,
mm-hmm.
I want to come to do that. You know, so I came in there as a kind of liaison, but really as a servant, and I really mm-hmm. carefully and just didn't cultivate it. I really felt that way and felt that I was there to be a missionary from the black community to the white community
mm-hmm.
and the white community to the black community, mm-hmm. the mutuality. I had this very uncomfortable feeling, and I still do, that white churches were very willing to give and support and do all these things, but it was always a kind of, we're giving you. And my feeling was that the black churches had the gift of their own particular experience and their strengths to bring to the table so that this was a mutual coming to the table. And I always felt that way. I felt very strongly that, and I resented it, the notion that some white congregants would give to me that, well, we're going to help you poor people. And I said, no, you don't need to help us poor people. We want to help you.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the kind of paternalism that Rochester is famous for, right?
That's right. And that's what, that came to focus in the Fight Kodak issue.
Sure.
Because Kodak was had a reputation as a liberal institution, and it was an earned reputation. They did some good stuff.
Yeah.
But it was always on their terms. And they had great difficulty in somehow changing their posture so that they weren't being the beneficent Eastman Kodak.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. How does the seminary as an institution respond to the riots? I mean, you've kind of moved on at this point, but I assume you're still in touch.
Oh, yes. Well, as an institution, I don't think the seminary did anything. I mean, they made no particular program out of anything, or I shouldn't even say that. Their actions were not direct. They had no direct connection. But as we began to try to seek some organized response to the riots that had occurred, and as the needs and desires of that community in Rochester began to be articulated, then we said, okay, we can use the resources of the council to reach some of the groups around the country, because at that time, SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and so forth. So Jim Bevel came up.
I'm glad you raised this. It's on my list of questions.
Okay.
Tell me how that process worked.
Well, it worked really well, I think. We called Dr. King's office
and the Council of Churches
through Herb White. He this was an urban ministry deal,
mm-hmm.
and my job as associate director was to help him mm-hmm. in terms of keeping the connections and mm-hmm. so forth. So Jim Bevel came up and spent a day or two with us. Jesse Jackson came,
okay,
and we spent some time with Jesse, and there was another
Andy Young.
Andrew, did he come up? He might have.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall. My relationship with him was, I didn't have it at that time, but I've since then become friends with
him. Mm-hmm.
But anyway, yes, and as we talked together with these guys, it became clear to us that the kind of church-based direction that SCLC represented with Dr. King and all that was not really quite the approach we thought that would be effective in Rochester, because we had some very disaffected people. On the other hand, we didn't want to abdicate that whole arena to the emerging Black Power movement. There were some organized things, but mostly it was amorphous, but very powerful. There were mm-hmm. figures coming out, and we began to think, well, somewhere between Black Revolution, which was being talked about, and the Southern Christian Leadership, there had to be something in between. I remember going to the Black Panthers one time.
In Rochester.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they had some guns and some stuff, and maybe a few sticks of dynamite or something. And they were going to have a revolution.
Mm-hmm.
I was scared to death. And I said to them, listen, now listen. You guys, each of you take out $1 million insurance policy and make me the beneficiary, because you're going to die out there if you go out there with these things. I said, the police had, and I knew they had anti-tank weapons and they can do a lot of damage to the community and kill these guys in the process. I was scared. I'm sitting there and I'm scared. And I said, I am scared, but I'm telling you the truth.
Was the Black Panther Party substantial in Rochester?
I never knew exactly the extent to which the party, but just if you had six of them, that mm-hmm. in the eyes of the people as confrontational as they were, people didn't know how many there were. And there were people, of course, who sympathized with them, so it was always amorphous. You didn't know how many there were. On the other hand, those who were vocal enough and articulate enough that they scared everybody else to death. Mm-hmm. So, and I knew some of those guys.
Who were they?
Oh, you know, to this, I'm being very honest. I cannot think of their names.
Okay, no, that's okay.
There was one woman, Mary something. I remember her. Big, heavy set lady. Mary, what was Mary's name? And she palled around with them anyway.
Mm-hmm. They have not been a very visible presence in all of my research. And so I'm a little curious.
But they were there.
Right.
They were there.
They were an element. They were an element. Okay, so you're somewhere between the sort of nationalist, revolutionary, and the SCLC. And so how are those decisions made? Who makes a decision that SCLC is not going to be the driving force?
I think that between conversations with Franklin and Herb Schenkel and some of the street folks, I can't think of their names, isn't that funny? Not Kenny Stevens. Who was the other guy? He was very vocal. That I was, oh, I can't. And Connie and John Mitchell, Mildred Johnson, mm-hmm. conversations with them, they say, well, man, you can't be bringing no church organization in because that was right. That'll kill you right off. Mm-hmm. So, on the other hand, they also recognized that kind of the Lakey. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, Lakey, but Lakey was more establishment because he was the city, he worked for. Hired for the Sibley, for what's the Sibley guy's name? It was commissioner, police commissioner. Anyway, so it was between those that we began to look around and say, well, who can we get? And Herb had done some research and came on Saul Alinsky.
Okay.
So in the meantime, there, you know, we had these confrontations. Well, they were conversations with the news media. Mm-hmm. And Al Newhart, who's now with the USA Today, I'll never forget one time we were in a meeting with him and I almost lost my temper and we almost came to blows. I'll never forget that one. But anyway, out of that, out of conversations with them and conversations with churches, knowing, and I think Mildred and even the militant people from the streets recognized that the church had to be involved.
Okay.
And they felt mainly that the black church had to be involved because it hadn't done anything, they felt. But they felt that it should be involved because they knew that it was a power base. And they also felt that the Council of Churches could be involved as a kind of broker for some of this stuff. So,
well, in fairness, it sounds like they would have had some experience with the Council of Churches already. If a number of these people are migrants, right, that are settling into Rochester, then there is at least the understanding that the Council of Churches...
Well, yeah, they knew the Council of Churches existed.
There's a familiarity.
And kind of a basic, and then basically that the Council was on the right track.
Right.
I think they felt that of all the church organizations would... The Council of Churches was pretty much as close as anybody could get to being something that would be
okay.
amenable to them.
Okay. So the decision is made?
To see, to talk with Saul Alinsky and see. Mm-hmm. So we went out to Chicago.
Who's we?
Murphy Greer, Herb Schenkel, Herb White, Dick Hughes, me, Franklin, and
Connie.
Yeah, Connie Mitchell went. Mm-hmm. And Mildred, I think. There were a group of us all went out to Chicago, had lunch with Saul. And he had us in stitches. He had a wonderful way of saying whatever he had to say in very humorous ways. He was talking about getting outside of people's experience. He said, let me show you. He goes over to some guy and says, is that your Lincoln out there with the the Wisconsin license plate on it. The guy says, oh, yeah. And he said, well, what was that? It was a bumper sticker, a Barry Goldwater. He said, well, some idiot put a Barry Goldwater sticker on your bumper. And the guy goes, and we're all dying.
Because he didn't put it down there.
Yeah, we're all dying. And it was so funny. Mm-hmm. But in our conversation with Saul, he knew more New Testament than a lot of preachers. I mean, the guy really knew the New Testament. Mm-hmm. And his biggest concern in our conversation was what it was going to involve in terms of the churches and those ministers who were going to be, he's talking about black and white ministers, because he felt if the council of churches was involved, that it was going to be a very strenuous experience. Mm-hmm. And he had great concern for the ministers, and I respected that. That was one of the reasons we thought, well, And on the other hand, we also knew that the work he had done with the yard, the
Becca Yards,
in Chicago,
the TWO, I can't think of what it stands for now, but TWO, Woodland,
and the Woodland or Woodland, mm-hmm. And then in California, his work with Cesar Chavez. Mm-hmm. So we felt, yeah, this was the kind of approach. Number one, it was tough, it was confrontational, but it wasn't violent. Right. He had never been arrested for anything that we knew anything about. And that it also emerged from the communities themselves, because it was a community really mm-hmm. organizing a community. Mm-hmm. We liked that. And his genius for talking and for ideas just really impressed us.
Okay.
So that's how we came to kind of center on Saul. Mm-hmm.
And so you go out, you meet with him.
Then we came back.
He's talking about crazy things, you know, giving people beans and sending them to the Philharmonic.
Well, that was later. Okay. That was all later. Sometimes we wondered about all this. But we knew that, for example, he had talked about integrating the Marshall Field stores in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And that they had this tactic where they knew that there would be somebody in that audience who was spying for the stores and all that kind of thing. So they let it be leaked that they were all going to go down and buy handkerchiefs down at Fields because they didn't have any people of color in sales positions there or in positions of authority. So, and they wanted to pick out the best handkerchiefs, so it took a while for each person to do this, but they were going to have all these people in the stores buying handkerchiefs. And, of course, that would tie up the store. I mean, that's really literally what it mm-hmm. Well, when that story got to the story to us was that when that story got to Marshall Field, that was going to take place on Saturday. On Friday, they integrated the Marshall Field staff.
Right.
Well, it was that kind of ingenuity.
Sure.
That was impressive.
It sounds like it was a kind of strategizing interview in some ways.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was, of course, his Don Quixote-ish approach to things was just really wonderful. So we thought, well, okay. So we had to get the churches on board.
Yes.
For this. Mm-hmm. So we got as much information about Saul and about the Woodlawn organization, their effort there, and the organization he represented in Chicago. And then we went out to churches. And our strategy was to develop a relationship, have those churches feel a relationship to what was going to go on there and to Saul. So I went out, we went out for a year, every night practically, to churches to explain why we were putting this kind of community organization into the picture. Mm-hmm. And we told them, you know, the alternatives are not good. Either you let this brew and you have something worse, or you got the black nationalist groups want to come in and want to do Rochester. So, or you've got this, which is impolite and all that, but hey, we think that the people in the black community will welcome this approach. That was the other part, and the very important part. So we had a series of meetings with just ordinary street folks. Some of them pastors, some were gang leaders, some were housewives. And we would talk about Helsinki and so forth.
Where are you holding these meetings? How do they come about?
In houses, in churches we would meet. Mm-hmm. We even met one time in Syracuse at one point. It could have gotten the other way. Mm-hmm. And very informally, mm-hmm. you know, we would meet with people. And so the consensus began to grow. And, of course, the newspapers found out about the effort immediately. And they helped us to organize the black community because they were against it. And a lot of people said, well, they're against it, I'm for it.
That's right. That's right.
There's a lot of, as I recall it, you know, there a lot of community attention and all that, but there were moments that were absolutely hilarious. They were just so funny because people would get to talking about this stuff in the vernacular. So that was, there were two things. We told them we're going to have to go to these white churches and communicate this process to them. So you got to trust me and a few others to go out there and do that. Mm-hmm. And 'cause, you know, they could go, but I think the distance between them and they, you know, some of them were not skilled diplomats. And
yes.
And you had to really be a diplomat. Mm-hmm. So I was chosen to do that. Went out night after night to explain this. Never will forget one time I was in Brighton in a church. Great big church, talking about Saul and this effort. And there was this huge cross up in the chancel area of this church. We're sitting down there in front of the church. And the members asking questions. One lady says, well, I just don't understand it. How in the world you could just, a council of churches could get this Jew to do this work? Saul Alinsky's a Jew. And I thank the Lord to this day. I don't know where it came from. I didn't even think about it for 2 seconds. Oh, that's hard. And I just looked up at the cross, turned around, looked at the lady. Jesus was a Jew.
You could, of course.
Heard a pin drop, and that lady just quietly said. And the newspapers were vehemently against it. And
why?
Well, they just thought that this man was too radical for Rochester. They didn't want any radicals coming to Rochester and rattling the cages.
They didn't realize they had radicals in Rochester already.
That's it. And there was one guy on the radio. His name was, what was that guy on the radio, Porsche, on WIBC? Richard. He had a very authoritative voice, and he was a commentator, and he was the Rush Limbaugh of his time.
Yes, I think I've seen old clips or heard old clips.
He challenged the then president, George W. Hill, who was president of the council. He challenged George to a debate on the radio on this business of fight and organizing with Saul Alinsky. Mm-hmm. What he didn't recognize or realize was that George had been a national debating champion. I said, George, just please don't do overkill. Because he handled this guy with humor. And I mean, by the time it was over, this guy's voice had gone from being a deep, authoritative voice to saying, well, I don't know what.
Right.
It was fun. Anyway, but that was the process. Mm-hmm. One, explain to the white churches how strategic this was, in saying to the black churches, you know, what do you want us, what kind of message do you want me to communicate? Because mm-hmm. they wanted me to be their spokesman as well.
Sure.
But I was grateful for that, because mm-hmm. there was an enormous amount of trust that both black and white communities were giving. And it was a burden, but I didn't recognize it as much. I think it was just more of a burden for Portia and the family because I was gone night after night after night.
Yeah, I actually, Herb White is one of the people that I interviewed on the phone. And, you know, his telling of going out to these churches, of, you know, going back to these churches, of having the conversation a third time, you know, why are we doing this?
Yep.
And, you know, so much hand-holding and really pounding the pavement to make this happen. So I understand that Alinsky requires signatures from the Black community. He wants to be invited by the Black community before he comes in. Is that right?
Yep, I believe I remember something of that. I can't remember it because I wasn't at that point. Herb was handling that aspect of it.
Okay, and so he comes.
Yep.
How does Fight form?
Well, they had a community meeting. Anybody, any families, churches, clubs, whatever, could become part of this effort. They had a big organizing convention, is really what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And they elected officers, and they elected that they hadn't yet become Fight.
That's right.
And they said, what's going to be our name? Mm-hmm. And they thought, well, we got to have something. Now, I don't know where it came from, probably from Alinsky and Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
But they elected Franklin to be the president at that point.
Were you at that first convention?
Mm-hmm.
What happened there? How do they elect Florence?
Well, it wasn't quite by acclamation. There were several people that they thought about as community leaders, even St. Julian Simpkins and others. There were delegations from the churches, and
uh-huh.
and they, you know, they had to register as delegates, and we all did. And they had caucuses, and the caucus, and Franklin's name just began to emerge, and he became the one to whom people looked. And I thought it was great because it was really a wonderful dynamic that mm-hmm. was taking place.
Mm-hmm. What an education for some of these people.
Oh yeah, and they'd never been involved in it, and a lot of them were like me. I'm as political as a stick of wood.
Sure.
But here I was, in, you know, uh-huh. up there in a caucus talking. As a matter of fact, I think my name was put up there at some point as something, uh-huh. as vice president or something. And I said, no, I felt that my position ought to be neutral. And
sure.
I wanted to stay where I was.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how it started. And they hadn't even picked the name yet.
Right.
And so that's the...
How did they make the decision that this was going to be an organization of organizations as opposed to of individuals?
Now, excuse me, I gotta go back. Stop!
No problem. Not a problem at all. Okay, so Fight has formed.
Mm-hmm.
Minister Florence has been elected. And what happens? How does Fight function?
Well, I think there was a lot, to me, anyway, I felt that there was what is the word I want to use? Tension
mm-hmm.
between the varying images that people had of what was really necessary to do.
Okay.
I think that some people, a lot of the church people, wanted the changes. They weren't absolutely sure about how you go about doing the things. Like, for example, there was a need for better housing, better jobs, but how do you do this? If you're going to the people who have the jobs, and I mean, some people felt, well, we can strongly say that we need the jobs and all that. Other people were saying, well, yeah, but you got to demand them. And so mm-hmm. there was this tension
mm-hmm.
between the approaches. And you know, I think African American communities are, well, they're just like a lot of other communities in that sense. People don't want impoliteness, and they've grown up with a sense of values that. That you're not rude to people and that sort of thing. So it was difficult for those groups, some of them, to accept the notion of the kind of approach that Saul Alinsky represented. And yet they wanted, they felt that it was necessary to have professional leadership, or to have some form of leadership that they could that they could recognize. So there was that. There were, of course, I think there were people, individuals, and I'm trying to think of who might be representative of that, who wanted to be leaders. Of course, there are a lot of folks who want to be that, and in the among the churches there are those, but I think as people began to talk about the issues, they began to realize that something had to be done. They found, it seemed to me, that they found that the churches could give them support in what they were seeking. Once the church had committed itself to it, I think that gave it some validity. I think they also felt, I'd never seen this before, at least it was not visible at the immediate level in Rochester, the need to have an organized effort in whatever you're doing. It's just not enough to have a single church here doing something and a family over there doing something. That really you could affect conditions, you could influence situations a lot more if there were more of you in common with each other. So that idea of unity began to be, I think, more than it used to be. Even the people who opposed fight in the church communities, in black churches, felt that they had to be unified, and you know, sometimes they would come as a unified group to protest something that was going on.
I'm gonna ask you this, and I have my motivations for doing it. I recognize this sense of unity. And so to clarify, you're saying this was not something you had seen in other places?
Not to the degree, not in an organized fashion as it was in fight.
Okay. I'm fascinated. I'm absolutely fascinated by these early years in Rochester. Because it's clear that all of these tensions you're describing existed. Mm-hmm. And yet, leading up to the riot, I think things start to change a little after the fact, but leading up to the riot, these various factions, we were joking on the way over about which black community, right?
Yeah,
The black communities managed to arrive at some kind of peace. There's some kind of a unity amongst these groups that, you know, in other cities, you see all kinds of rivalries and problems, and there doesn't seem to be this organization that you're referring to. And I see it in Rochester prior to that.
Sure.
There isn't the class conflict. Not that it doesn't, the tension isn't there, but it's not that kind of conflict. It's, you know, you have NAACP attorneys testifying on behalf of Nation of Islam, you know, adherents. These are the kinds of divides that people were sort of able to overcome in Rochester. And I'm at a loss as to explain it.
Well, I think part of it just occurred to me, and I may not be right on this, I have to think about it, but I think there was not the political structure in Rochester that there is in many cities.
Mm-hmm. Meaning?
That there are ward bosses and there are the people in the community who are the political stars and around whom these clusters of power get to be pretty visible and pretty structured. Mm-hmm. I didn't see that in Rochester. I didn't see...
Because they're
there
not
was,
there.
There was no boss that people went to in Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
They went to a Mildred Johnson, this lady who had an informal social agency. They'd go to her, or they'd go to their church or something. And in a sense, they were leaders of the various communities that we were talking about. But they didn't have the kind of political structure, quasi-political structure, that you see in a lot of other cities.
Okay. I suspect that this has to do with again, the migration patterns. Mm-hmm. Right? There isn't time for all that to develop in Rochester.
That's right.
Most of these people have just come.
That's right.
I mean, the population, a lot of them, right?
Just bloomed. Uh-huh. Although there had been, you know, Rochester
sure.
had a long, long-standing black community.
Absolutely.
But, and then again, I think that community was a black community in a lot of senses, but in a different way, they were not a black community. That is, they were black. They had the church, primarily, as the organization that represented community, if there was. Mm-hmm. But I think they saw themselves as Rochesterians first.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. I've been reading a lot lately. They see themselves as Rochesterians first. And it's not that they are not aware of the race issues that are happening.
Right.
But again, I mean, we talked about this in the car. They seem to come to some kind of truce with white Rochester.
Exactly.
This works for you. It's imperfect, but it works for us.
True. It's an accommodation.
Yeah.
Without giving up, you know, yourself in the process. Mm-hmm. You give up a lot. You can give up a lot if you can maintain your sense of self. And I think that's what happened.
Yeah. It's very, very interesting dynamics. But again, I think this this organization is key. I mean, I think it's one of the things that makes Rochester so strong in terms of producing a kind of model for what's possible.
Right.
Okay. So Fight is functioning, and they decide they're going to take on Eastman Kodak. Tell me about that.
Well, yeah.
How does it start? How does it develop? Where does
it go? Well, my recollection is not, that's been so long ago, but I think the notion came out of the fact that Eastman Kodak, along with Xerox, along with Bausch & Lomb, with these major corporations, wanted to do something. And Eastman was very proud of its record, and did have a good record, mm-hmm. of being a liberal white company. And I think that Alinsky wanted to change the dynamic of the thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, as I think about it now, and I haven't really, put all that together, but I suspect that what came into the Fight Kodak struggle in terms of the proposition was partly Alinsky. Part of it, I think, came out of the community itself, which said, okay, we know better. We know our folk better than you do. You think you know us. And this was an underlying emotional dynamic that was taking place that I think was aided in some respects, not just by the white press, but even by churches in their efforts to be supportive and be beneficent and all that sort of thing. It gave the impression that, well, we know what you need, and so we'll go along with this. Mm-hmm. Even the Fight organizational effort, community organization effort itself, having the acquiescence of the churches was sort of like saying, well, okay, we can put up with that if we know what. Mm-hmm. So when this came along, when this program came along, it was very simple. Fight said, we want, 600 people to get jobs for 600 people. Of course, Kodak says, no problem. And Fight says, well, we want to train them. Now, there's certain technical training that you can do, because we can't do that. We don't know how to do photography, whatever. But when you take the people that we're talking about, we want in there. They are people who do not have the kind of experience, life experience, that you think is just automatic. And we know that it's not. For example, if on a Monday morning, somebody's got to call some guy who's not been used to having to get up at 6 o'clock on Monday morning and say, get up out of bed, you got to go to work. Mm-hmm. So it was that kind of practical thing that Fight was talking about. And I think the other thing was, if I remember correctly, I can't remember where it was. It was either in the newspapers, it was in the editorial on the news, that these poor people, the poor community, the poor whatever of Rochester, they called them poverts.
Poverts?
Poverts.
Okay.
Now, you know, that's a terrible word.
It's a terrible word.
It's a terrible word.
It's P-O-V-E-R-T-S?
Yes.
Okay.
And they said, well, the reason they used this kind of nomenclature was that these were people who didn't have job skills.
Mm.
And I said, no, I used to go around, and I've said this many times, I don't know that it's written anywhere, but it's true. I did say it in many places. You're wrong. It is not that these people have no job skills. It's the fact that most of the people who came to Rochester lately came from agrarian states. They had skills in agriculture. This is an industrial economy. It's just the fact that their skills don't match the skills that you're talking about. They've got skills. And they did. They had all kinds of skills that farm workers and people of that kind would achieve over years. So I took umbrage at the language that was used to describe people and at the attitude that said they didn't have skills. And so when it came to working this out, I was with the negotiating committee, and they put together this little statement that said, you know, the Fight will partner with Eastman Kodak, using the word partner very carefully, would partner with Eastman Kodak to make certain that community people were introduced and absorbed into the market. And that's really essentially the language that was the statement that we were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so things, they were guarded, but they were okay. And we went on working. I can't remember now who, because I didn't go with Franklin and Herb and those guys on the first kind of negotiating sessions. But Franklin called me and said, boy, they're getting kind of stuck. And I said, what's getting stuck? Well, we're getting stuck because these guys want to be all technical. And I said, oh, I knew that they were talking about legal language.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed that the industrial park had started the negotiations. Now, they were unionized. The other part of the company was not.
Okay.
And so, if I remember correctly, when the initial kinds of agreements were made, that everything was fine. It was taken to the legal department. And there, I can't remember the name of that guy, Ken something or other, who headed up their team. They began to balk on this business. So, and Franklin just went, you know, like this, and he swelled up. And negotiations broke down.
Mm-hmm.
That was early in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And for several weeks, things were a stalemate. In the meantime, if I remember correctly, Bill Vaughn resigned as president, and Louis Eilers became the president. And
right.
I was invited up to his office one time for lunch. I'll never forget it as long as I live.
Okay.
Mr. Eilers went on to describe their position, and I was trying to explain to him that Fight was in a position to be the contact with these folks, many of whom didn't have the experience of working in that kind of situation. And he said, well, you know, at one point, you know, we did your folks, we did you an enormous favor. We took you out of Africa where you were eating worms and things and got you, you know. I said, Mr. Eilers, number one, why do you want to bother people who are very happy in their own culture? They're perfectly happy. If they don't need all these gadgets. I said, if they're happy with what they're doing, they're a lot happier than some of the people in your corporation. That's what I told him. It was insulting.
To say the least.
Very insulting. But, you know, his background was as an engineer, I think. It was not in human relations, certainly.
Clearly.
So, I came away from there feeling, oh my God. who is this man? So, they were stuck. And finally, I got a call from Third Presbyterian Church. At there was a fellow in that church who was also had become a staff member on the Council of Churches, Eugene Tennis. And I got a call from Gene telling me that there was a man named John Mulder, who was a vice president, and that Mulder would at least talk about it. And I said, well, that's all that's all I can hope for, because at that point, nothing was going on. And Franklin, we talk every now and then, but nothing.
Now, Mulder was a member of Third Presbyterian, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
So this was, again, the churches negotiating, facilitating.
Way, yeah.
Okay.
And I think, actually, the pastor of the church was not necessarily the guiding spirit behind this. I think it was in the church people, the membership itself.
Mm-hmm.
So John, I called John, and he said, well, I can give you a half hour. And I said, well, that's good enough. Let's just talk. So I went to meet him. I didn't know him. And we chatted a little bit, and finally, in the last 10 minutes, we started to talk about the fight situation, and I tried to explain it from our position. And he said, well, you know, there are legal ramifications. And I said, well, of course there are. But you know, this is a community organization. They're not lawyers. They just want something to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ended up, what started out as a half-hour lunch became 3 hours. And we sat and talked and we walked. And at the end of the day, John said, well, let's meet again. I said, okay. So he went back and talked to his folks, and I went back and reported to Franklin. And I said, well, he's open. And I said, we can go at it again. So we did. And finally, it ended up we had a session with John and there were three or four people from Eastman Kodak and the Council of Churches. Dick Hughes was there. Herb. And there were, seems to me that there was another minister from the United Church of Christ. And we all met down in the hotel down there, my motel down there in downtown in Rochester. And this went on for about 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, we said, well, why don't we just make a statement that just says that we will cooperate with each other on its own. It was merely that. It didn't get... And that the goal was to meet. And I think we used the word goal, if I remember correctly. I got that paper somewhere here.
I have a copy of it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But I wrote the original thing, typed it, and then we'll forget it. And so then we could get to the press.
If I can just ask you here, why was this so important to fight?
Well, I think it was important because it would further validate fight as a negotiating institution with the business and industrial community.
Kodak recognizes us. We've arrived.
Yeah, pretty much. I think that, and it wasn't that they depended upon that, But mm-hmm. I think it just validated what they were making. It helped to substantiate their claim to represent their people.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And because there was nothing else. I mean, no political party, no other. The Black Panther Party certainly wouldn't. And so I think that it was further validation of their position as kind of pivotal in the community.
Absolutely. I mean, the only thing that fight has at this point, and I've read this material a number of times, what they have is the threat of violence, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
You know, Florence essentially says time and time again, you can deal with us in this way, or you're going to have long, hot summers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And long, hot summers was a stand-in. I mean,
that's right.
It's language.
And I think Franklin was... He was saying that from two points of view.
Mm-hmm.
One as a quasi-political leader.
Mm-hmm.
The other as a church person. I think he really truly felt that this was a prophetic message that you had to do this. You have choices. You can either live or die, and this is the path. This is the way to death, and this is the way to life. Mm-hmm. I think to use church language.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was enough church influence in this to see it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think the churches saw it not so much as a political... And this is the difference... This is what I wanted to say this to you, too, earlier. This was one of the differences in perspective of the Caucasian churches who saw fight and this whole business as a kind of political exercise. Well, fight saw it as in political terms, but they saw it as a kind of spiritual struggle for hearts and minds, and because this had to do with saving souls in terms of understanding in the Black church.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't so much just to gain political power and be the institution. It was, and I think the whole civil rights movement, the reason that it had the power that it did was because it saw itself in spiritual terms. And I think that was the same thing with fight.
Mm-hmm.
It was essentially, but some of the meetings were like revival meetings. You'd go and people would sing, and it was really wonderful. And I thought about that because the struggle was not just in terms of gaining a social end, some kind of social goal. It was to fulfill the destiny that we felt God had called us to,
mm-hmm.
as a people.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't to turn the tables. It wasn't to be over the white church. It was to be a partner with and a part of. And that's even that took an institutional an organizational bit. When I became that, my portfolio changed to be the Council of Churches executive for Black church ministries, and I used all my time and effort to go and be with Black churches in it. And it used to tickle me because I come from a very humble Baptist church background, so I was very much and very Pentecostal.
Mm-hmm.
So I am very much at home when you clap the hands and have the tambourine. I'm feeling very much at home. They couldn't get used to that. They think the Council of Churches executive, he's up here clapping his hands. And I wasn't putting it on. I was having as much of a spiritual experience as they were. And it just tickled me. I remember one morning I went to a church and it was about as big as 20 feet long or 30 feet long, and it was cold. It was early February, and I didn't have a regular church responsibility, so I would go visit. And I went to this little storefront church where when you come in, there's no vestibule.
Mm-hmm.
You're right in it.
That's right.
And as I walked in the door, the minister announced that I was going to preach. Now, I had not been invited to preach, but that's the way it was. That was a pattern of some of these little churches.
Sure.
So I always had a little sermon in my back pocket. And I went up there, and of course, it was just essentially a one-step-up platform, and they had a little desk, a little podium. And when it came time to preach, I got up and I started preaching about the prodigal son, and in true fashion amongst our black ministers, by the time I got to the third point, I was going. I was in high gear. And I started talking about this Jewish boy feeding pigs, and I was going... I mean, I had my tone, and there's a lady on the front row, she's pretty big, and she leaned up and said, "You better cut that out," which was the pattern. Our church's congregation was call and response, a lot of it, mm-hmm. And this lady tickled me to death. I had to laugh myself at that one, but it was that kind of dynamic that was taking place at the same time we were doing all this negotiating.
Yeah.
And I think the wonderful thing about that for me was that John Mulder didn't understand all that. He didn't understand all that. But I was surprised and delighted at this man who didn't know me that well, but who really honored me by giving me his trust to try to make these connections, which we did. Mm-hmm. And it was about... after we had signed the agreement, and then about 2 or 3 days before Christmas, they were having a party at our house. Franklin and Shankles and all of them, we were all over there celebrating the fact that this thing had been done. And I get a call about 10 o'clock at night from John Mulder. And he said, "Marvin, I got to talk to you right away." And I could tell from his voice that something was really bad. I had no idea what it was. He came over. He said, "Can I come over?" I said, "Well, by all means." He came over to my house, and we went into an upstairs room while they were downstairs talking. And he told me that they had reneged on the agreement. And I said, "Oh, my God, John. We've got to tell Franklin." He said, "I know." And I said, "Well, he's here." He said, "Well." So we went downstairs and told Franklin, and Franklin went livid. I mean, absolutely livid. And he was not a cursing man, but he just, you know, how could they do this? And so then he was going to go public right away with the fact that they reneged, and of course he did. So through that, even though all that had happened, I still called John and he would call me. We remained friends until he died. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, they kicked him sideways. He was in line to really become a president, I think, at some point. But what we didn't know about the reneging on that agreement was that there was an intra-company struggle going on at that point between the powers of the CEO, the president of the board and the president of the company, the chairman of the board and the president. We had no idea, but that was the dynamic that was going on inside that company.
And Louis Eilers is... the president of the company or the chairman of the board?
He was... I thought he was president of the company.
Okay, I don't recall.
I think he took Bill Horn's place.
I think that's right. Yeah. I think that's right.
I think that was it. But there was this struggle, whatever it was. And, of course, this got in the middle of it. And that really... that became a very costly and terrible episode. You know, our good friend Lee Bainan, who was a minister of the First Baptist Church, hanged himself in the church under the pulpit.
I've heard that story.
And he had been to our house. He and Richard Norman Hughes, I just saw his daughter, Dick's daughter, mm-hmm. not long ago. They were over at our house, and just like a night or two before he did that. Lee Bainan was very upset. He was a gentle man. But they had put him and his family through, they meaning we don't know who, but some, they'd gotten veiled threats, cold phone calls at 3 a.m, heavy breathing, someone loosened the lug nuts on their car. It was pretty bad.
This is the white people in the white community.
Some middle management people, you know, work for Eastman Kodak Company.
And what was his position that he was targeted?
Lee, mm-hmm. Well, he was the pastor of a very influential church, and he was one of the leaders of the Council of Churches, and very visible. Had many, and he had spoken out very forthrightly, you know, on behalf of the fight of the Council of Churches program.
Rochester, at this point, is It's only about 40 years out from the big Klan vacation, right?
Yep.
I mean, the Klan was alive and well in Rochester.
Yeah.
And so this doesn't surprise me.
No. I didn't know that much about the Klan, and that part. Later on, I was told that they had been. Of course, I was from Indiana, where the Klan was headquarters.
Stronghold.
So we knew about all that, but that's right. Don't worry. You know, I think it was the iron fist in the velvet glove. Institutions are very moral in one respect. You can always depend upon them to protect their interests. They will do whatever is necessary to maintain the integrity of the institution. Doesn't mean that it's moral in the sense that you and I generally mm-hmm. thought of as morality. Mm-hmm. But they are moral in the sense that they are going to be coincident with whatever their idea of what they are about. So that's what that was.
How does it affect the black communities? Let's start there. How does the struggle between Fight and Kodak affect what's happening in the black communities? Because it goes on for nearly 2 years.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, that's a really
well,
long...
I think I was surprised. No, I take that back. I wasn't surprised, but I was impressed with the staying power that these churches and communities. We went out a lot. I mean, I went out, but having the base in the church was wonderful because there people could maintain the sense that this was not just a political struggle. This had to do with people's lives, and you were trying to do something, so you had to stay with it. And
this is God's work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was seen that way. I made lots of visits to the Church of God and the little Pentecostal Church of God in Christ and others, and the AME Zion Church. And fortunately, while I was a Council of Churches executive, I was being a choir director in one of the gospel choir director in one of the churches. So I had that identification. Mm-hmm. And so people could see the churchiness of what the struggle was about. And that helped.
And how did you all keep the people that were not affiliated with the church involved? So they're labeled, right? This hardcore unemployed, like this
right,
sort of untouchables.
What? The street folks.
Right.
Well, I went around with them too. I'd go to the taverns. I sat in a lot of bars, and I had a so-called street ministry. I would just be on the street every night, practically talking with guys and in all kinds of situations, and if trying to work with Mildred and other people. If Mildred needed something, she'd call me up. Some folk needed something down there to the Podunk Church, mm-hmm. we'd go down there. And I just sort of like, I was a minister at, somebody said minister at large. I always thought that was funny. Mm-hmm. But it was pretty apt. I was a minister at large. And you know what's, you know, Laura, that really affected my sense, not only of ministry, but of my relationship to the church. Because as a minister, I'm a servant of the church. But I have a hard time with Christianity. So I've quit calling myself a Christian. I call myself a follower of Jesus. There was just so much distance between what I saw as institutionalism and what I saw in dealing with just ordinary folks.
Yeah.
And always keeping in mind, you know, I sat on so many wet diapers where I'd gone into somebody's house, and there's this young mother who had greased her little baby really well. Sweet babies, mm-hmm. with their hair combed tightly and plaited tightly, mm-hmm. and it'd be hotter blazes, and the place would look like I don't know what, but the babies were healthy and the mothers were proud. And I think about that. And that, and the one thing that being a pivotal person in that whole business was that it allowed me to exercise that ministry. And it was only later that I began, because I became the Council of Churches executive in San Francisco as well, I made it a part of my contract with the councils to spend at least an hour of every day with people. Just being with people. Eating at the McDonald's and nothing else. Just being on the street. Because to me, being an officer, being a facilitator in an institution can really remove you from the humanity of the purposes if you're not careful. So I wanted to maintain that sense of connection. Mm-hmm. And not just for the people, for the sake of the people I was trying to serve, but for my sake as well. Mm-hmm. And so that was a great thing.
Was that typical in Rochester?
No. You mean of being the... I don't quite get your question.
The desire on the part of ministers to straddle that space between being of the church and being with the people.
Okay. I think there was but it was more in the traditional sense that the minister, but he's still the leader and kind of like here.
Mm-hmm. This elevated position.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And they saw me as not, well, I was Reverend Chandler, all right, and a minister, but I wasn't pastoring. Pastoring has this kind of aura about being up there, and they weren't quite sure. I think they respected my spirituality. They weren't sure how that worked with being an ordained minister in the church, especially if you were out there in the streets and you know, I wasn't playing jazz, but I was out there, and then I was anywhere, and then I was in the churches, you know, Sunday, you know. Mm-hmm. They were never quite able to figure that out. I don't blame them. I wasn't either, but at least I had a starting point, I felt.
Yeah.
They did pretty well. Franklin and Schenkel and Murphy Greer and those guys, they learned how to be a little, to have their feet a little more on the ground. Because mm-hmm. they had to. Mm-hmm. And I highly respected them for that. Because it took effort not to take yourself so seriously as the reverend and the elder and minister Florence and so forth. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, those guys could have really just taken themselves very seriously and gone off. They didn't.
While we're on the subject, tell me more about the Rochester Area Ministers Conference. Tell me.
Well, we decided to call ourselves Rochester Area Ministers Conference as opposed to the Council of Churches, as opposed to something else, because this was inclusive enough that anybody who wanted to join it, who was a minister, could. It was, I think there were maybe one or two women. I remember them. I don't think there were any women in it, which is not unusual in black churches, of course. And it was kind of a fellowship. We met for breakfast and most of the time and just kind of kept each other up to date. And we would strategize in terms of what the churches could say and do in the bigger meetings so that the ministers were pretty much together if they wanted to support a particular thing. If they thought that something was not appropriate or something that they shouldn't, then they felt that it was better to speak with one voice. And that's very true. But it was more of a brotherhood, more of a kind of giving group support to an individual minister. And there were times when churches needed the broader support for their own particular circumstance, mm-hmm. and that was given. It was, and then they felt that helped them, and I wasn't their spokesman. They had guys who would meet with the Council of Churches or with other denominations. Sometimes the denominations would go singly to them and ask about stuff. So, as they would say, behind my back, I didn't care. I said, I don't care how you go. You can do whatever you want to.
Sure.
But my feeling was that this was, they were attempting to be a black ecumenical organization. The difference between what they were as Rochester Ministers Conference and my position was that I was trying to have a broader black presence as a kind of arm of the Council of Churches from black churches that would have lay representation rather than just clergy, because there were a lot of ministerial groups. Mm-hmm. But there was nothing in the black communities that was like a black Council of Churches that had representatives from the congregations that may or may not be ministers. They could be lay people and should be lay people.
I see.
And that was a very, and I forgot, we had a name for it at one point, and then it got lost in the shuffle. But they did work. I mean, it worked that way. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I gave a report on what had happened in Rochester to the National Council of Churches board meeting a little later on. And it was out of that board meeting that a national group, ecumenical black group, was formed. And their first person was, what did they call that organization? It's still going. And their first executive was a guy named Don Jacobs, a Methodist minister out of Cleveland, Ohio.
Do you have any idea how frequently in the course of these interviews I have heard where something that was born in Rochester is presented on this broader field,
yeah,
and it has become a model for a national organization or strategy, yeah, or what have you?
Well, that, yeah, that, for example, after the riots in Attica, there was a group of United Church women started court watching, they called it. And they watched the process in court to see if justice was being done. And they saw instances where it wasn't right. It was out of that. And there was a guy, there were two. There was a guy named Bill Lincoln, who was honored with me a couple of weeks ago.
He's a Rochester guy.
And there was another guy, Bob, what was Bob's name? He and I were on the streets doing this kind of street ministry type thing, out of which there was a woman named Jenny Mackey. And the Church Women United group became the Judicial Process Commission. And the Judicial Process Commission was a kind of watchdog thing that became a national group. And Jenny ended up at Boulder, Colorado. That was her headquarters after that. But that became a national program. Mm-hmm. And it grew out of that street ministry,
right,
that we were doing in Rochester.
Right. You mentioned Attica, and it's one of the things that's on my list of topics to discuss. Do you want to do that, or should we finish with the Rochester stuff?
Well, let's go with the Rochester. If you have other...
I do, actually.
Now, some of this, if we don't get to it today...
We can do it on the phone, sure.
And I'll be glad to spend as much time as you want to spend.
No, it's not a problem at all. I appreciate that. So, there's two sort of these broader trends that I'm really interested in that again, sort of start in Rochester or, you know, come to fruition there. One of them is black theology, and the other is black capitalism. And so in terms of the black theology, of course, James Cone, Gay Rod Wilmore are both invited at different points to Colgate, Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
What is going on there? Why Rochester? What's the relationship, again, between the seminary and the city?
Well, I think that Gay Wilmore came as a result, partly as a result of the black students and their situation at Colgate Rochester. They had lockdown at Colgate Rochester, out of which became a black chair, a temporary chair. It was called Martin Luther King Jr. Chair, and a fellow named Dr. Henry Mitchell became the chairperson for that, and at the first year that they organized that. And then Gay Wilmore came after that.
Mm-hmm.
But the first person was Henry Mitchell.
Okay.
And
so why did the students take over? What's that story?
Well, that was part of the whole push for kind of what's the word I want to use? There was a desire on the part of the black students at Colgate Rochester to have more say in the whole process, I think, mm-hmm. from a black perspective. They wanted the African-American perspective included. Now, it's very interesting because Gene Bartlett was the president, and Gene and I, he was a good friend. And he had every good wish and desire, but they had no idea how they could respond institutionally to what the students were talking about. And of course, they found a way after the kids locked the place down. But I think this was one, they wanted the black church to be a part of the whole curriculum and the whole institutional stance.
Mm-hmm. That all of the students were learning from.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And so they thought that hadn't been taken seriously, which is, you know, they were not included really in a significant way, and that was simply because that's the way things were in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they decided to change the way
the days
were
are
going to
change.
Days.
That's right.
So that's, and I think it was, I think it had. There was no cogent theological statement that guided that process. I think any theological statements came out of the process, which is a good theology, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I think good theology doesn't start there, and then, you know, the process. The process creates the theology that comes out of it.
Sure.
And it's so, but then you had black church theologians who were talking about, you know, about black theology on the national level, but I don't think that was really in the minds of those students at that point. They wanted to establish this. I didn't see it as kind of, certainly to my knowledge, not a coordinated and cohesive process that mm-hmm. said we're going to end up with this.
Mm-hmm.
That was not it, I think. Gay came later, and gave a more scholarly basis for the black church and its dynamics of the black church and the theology. But I remember one time later when Leon Pacala was president of Colgate Rochester, there were some people agitating for Colgate Rochester to lower its standards in order to lower the standards of entry requirements in order to facilitate greater numbers of African American students.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Leon and I said, "Now listen, do whatever you want to do. Get a mentor program, get a tutorial program, do whatever you want, but don't lower the standards. The people who come to Colgate Rochester, black and white or whatever, come here to the school partly because of its excellence in its level of theological training. And I don't think we need to short shrift the black church because you want to get more people in. Give them some help, but keep the standard." Leon just laughed at that. But I felt that very deeply because the scholarship of the people who did go to Colgate Rochester was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't get there, and then you didn't stay there if you didn't really meet some level of the scholarship. So, and I didn't want to drop that for the black church because I felt, if anything, we needed more excellent leadership than we had.
Sure. I was in Atlanta last week, and one of the places that I visited was the King Center. I wanted to look at some of the archives. And so in the process of searching for materials on this trip that James Bevel made to Rochester, one of the things that popped up were all of the people involved with SCLC who had been trained at Colgate Rochester. It's like, I had no idea. I mean, it was huge. Huge numbers.
A lot of these people, you know, when I think about some of them to this day, I mean, it's an amazing thing. But I think it was because those people, from whatever their historic background, their personal history, and the history of their churches, that Colgate Rochester enjoyed a reputation for being a progressive institution that understood the connection between religion and the social dynamics.
Yeah.
They did.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Fight eventually moves in the direction of black capitalism. How are you involved in that?
I wasn't.
Okay.
I actually didn't have much at all to do with that. At that point, my job had kind of moved from being this direct liaison to working more with the Rochester Urban Ministers Conference, just being present and, you know, doing the ministerial thing. I did a whole bunch of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then Fight had a succession, the after Franklin, I think Raymond, DeLeon McEwen.
DeLeon McEwen. Then Florence again.
Then, yeah, and Bernie
Gifford. Then
Gifford.
Then Scott.
Then,
So,
and it's so kind of funny because I knew Raymond Scott in Buffalo. When my first church assignment was at Salem United Church of Christ. And there was Raymond and Clarence, his brother, who were young people in that church. And we laugh about that, as Scotty and I were laughing about, oh, and you just reminded me, I've got to send him a CD, a jazz CD, I promised him, if I can get it from Everett. So, anyway, that was and I think DeLeon did more. It started with Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
And after the Fight Kodak struggle, out of it came the idea of Fight On.
Mm-hmm.
But Franklin did so much to really head up the process. And took a lot of heat from a lot of people. And not just white people. He got it from the black community as well, with some people. And there were all kinds of accusations floated around, as they always do with people in leadership, you know, about him being on the take and all this. I never, ever, in all of my experience with Franklin, some of it, and of course there were people who were a lot closer to him maybe than I was, except that we were always friends. But I can, to this day, I would stand on a book, on a truckload of Bibles and say, I've never seen Franklin do anything crooked. Never anything wrong in that, you know. He was not a dishonest man.
There, I have encountered some questions, is probably the best way to put it, about money down the line, but the finger has never been pointed at Franklin. Not ever. He was rough. He was rough. He was abrasive. But nobody's ever said he was crooked.
He had immense integrity. And Raymond, you know, same thing. Of course, it's in people in positions of leadership, that's always true. People that used to wonder if I wasn't. One time I had a group of ministers because I was doing another program in another council, and there was a government program where they would fix your church kitchen up and give you new study equipment and everything, and then they'd run the program out of your church.
Mm-hmm.
I went to this group of ministers, told them about the program, and they said, now look, we're just a bunch of poor preachers. I said, no, there is no money under the table. If you want to know what my salary is, you can go right down there to that council office and look at it, because it's public knowledge. That's my salary. I don't get paid from anybody else. Never did, because it's a lot less trouble, number one. I didn't want to violate my own sense of integrity to begin with, but number one, it just doesn't make sense.
Right.
But anyway, Franklin, no.
Yeah.
And I don't know what went on with Fight On. I kind of looked at it from afar.
Okay. What did it look like from afar?
Well, I think I felt that it was a struggle. And that it wasn't just a struggle to get an honest relationship with the white industrial business community. Because the Rochester Chamber of Commerce and the industrial, what do they call themselves? They used to tickle me because they were so very much self-serving. Anyway, I watched that and wondered how they were going to manage, first of all, to create a business. I mean, a really significant business, because that's a complicated process. And who were they going to get to help them? To, you know, who had the expertise? I knew that Franklin didn't have that kind of expertise. I mean, I didn't know of anybody. Mm-hmm. And Walter Cooper, and there was another guy there, community, who was outside to fight. Well, Walter was in and out sometime, but these were people who had an intellectual level of competence that you said, but they were not business people either. They didn't have a record mm-hmm. for creating big businesses. So how are they going to do that? Mm-hmm. And I didn't follow it closely, but that one of the questions I kept wondering was how in the world they did, and I don't know how they pulled it off, even to the point of having Fight On even ever begin. Mm-hmm. But they had a big, you know, ribbon cutting in the whole business. And it was a significant business there for a while.
Yeah.
I lost track of it.
Continues to exist today.
Does it?
Mm-hmm. It's under, when it changed hands in 75, Matt Augustine bought mm-hmm. a controlling interest. He still runs it. I interviewed him.
For heaven's sake.
But he changed the name to Eltrex.
Eltrex.
And it still exists.
That's wonderful.
Still serves the same kind of mission and purpose.
That's marvelous. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad to know, and I'm glad that it came out of that. Well, there were cause ancillary things. Friends of Fight, we mentioned that a little while ago. Mm-hmm. And I always thought the problem with Friends of Fight was that they tried to be blacker than the black people.
I'm not really sure what that means, but I hear you.
They tried to be more militant, and more out there, more what. And they didn't understand that for black people, this was a necessity. This was not a hobby. You didn't get your jollies by going out there and taking a chance on getting your head beat in.
Yeah.
This was necessary. And I think that was part of it. And of course, they had, you know, I think their motives were like all human motives. They were mixed. But they did have, at some level, they had this business of wanting to be. But then I think there was also a slight tinge of arrogance that says, we know. They used to tell me, you know, they didn't think the Council of Churches was militant enough. Mm-hmm. And I look at these guys and say, you're crazy. You want to go out there and get your head whipped? Going out there. I'm not going out there and get my head whipped unless it's absolutely necessary. If it is, I will, but I'm not going to. We didn't go around there looking. Franklin didn't go around looking for fights. They came to him most of the time.
Right.
These people, anyway, well, enough of that. Except that I think that that's always a danger.
Mm-hmm. No, I think everything you said is borne out in the record, in the material of that group. Tell me about Attica. Tell me how you came to be involved in 71.
Oh, okay. Well, that was a huge... A huge experience that started when Franklin called me, and I knew about it. I knew that something had happened at Attica. A lot of course, it was in the papers and all that on Thursday. And Franklin called me on Thursday night, or Friday morning early, actually it was, and said that some of the women and girlfriends, some of the prisoners and their families wanted to know how they were, and we didn't know, and the only way we could find out was to go down there. And he had made a contact with the sheriff of Monroe County, and the sheriff said he'd take us down there. So we got down there, and you know, there had been the initial disturbance, and a guard had either had been pushed or fell from a catwalk, and he died.
I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's all right.
You were there with Franklin or Ray Scott or both?
With Raymond.
Okay.
Raymond called me. I beg your
okay,
pardon.
No, no,
at that
okay.
point,
just,
Raymond was president.
I just wanted to make sure that I had...
No, Ray Scott was president. It was Raymond who called me. Franklin did come down there, by the way. He did get down there.
But later that day. Okay.
Yeah. Raymond and I got down there early at 4 o'clock in the morning or something. And in every awful situation, there are things that just tear you up, which are mm-hmm. so funny. Like... I had to go to the bathroom, and we were outside of this huge place, and it's about like a fortress, and it had a guardhouse in the gate. Well, the chaplain of the prison, I knew him, so I go over to whisper to him that I had to go to the bathroom. And he says, oh, come on. So we go in, the guard lets us in this little restroom, and I come back out. And there's suddenly all kinds of cameras going, and reporters and microphones, and they're going, what's happened? What's going on in there? And I said, I'm not at liberty to say.
Well, a black man coming out of the bathroom, of course you must know what's going on.
Well, they didn't know that. They just saw me coming out of this guardhouse out of the wall. And they want, you know, it's so funny because
sure.
news people are on the scenes and they're so hungry for news.
Of course.
They just ask any, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I laughed, but it wasn't long after that Scotty and I got this. Somebody approached us who was an official. I don't even remember the guy's name now, but wanted to know if we would be willing to work with the negotiating team that they were putting together and the prisoners. And I said, well, what do you mean? They said, well, they wanted us to be not negotiators, but to kind of help the process along. And actually, I think they just wanted us to give it legitimacy.
Yeah.
As black ministers. So we both knew what that meant. But we also took seriously the fact that if they asked us to do that, then that's what we were going to do. So it didn't take us but a second or two to say, yeah, we'd do it. But Minister Scott said, well, we're willing to do this, but we have to have the assent of the prisoners. And they said, well, you can't go down there because they're down there in Courtyard D and, well, something could happen to you. And we said, well, there's no way we can do this because unless we get their consent, there's absolutely no reason why they would trust us. And therefore, we wouldn't have any, we have no... validity as far as those guys are concerned. So they made us sign a paper that said that absolved the state of any responsibility. So Scotty and I went down there, and these guys said, well, man, do whatever you can because, you know, we want to get this thing straightened out. And they gave Scotty some idea about the list of demands they were putting together.
Did you know many of them?
I didn't know any of them.
Okay.
I didn't know a single soul there. Scotty knew one or two.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think he knew many of the guys.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very interesting because, and we didn't see their faces. They had scarves and turbans and stuff.
Uh-huh.
But they said, do what you can, and we said, okay, man. And for some reason, I knew that, you know, these guys were not Sunday school teachers. Most of the people in prison at places like Attica are probably there because they did something. So you know you're dealing, and I've been on the streets long enough to know that I'm dealing with the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
These are guys and criminals.
It's a maximum facility.
That's right.
These aren't petty crimes.
And so, but at the same time, you've helped me to remember something here that was a feeling that I've kept all these years, and that is these are human, these are my brothers. You know, these are men, yeah, they did awful things. And some things that I haven't done, but there are things that I feel are awful. Maybe they're not awful, but at least they were awful to me. So we're here, and we're in this situation. Well, anyway, we go back up there and tell the guy that, you know, and that these prisoners wanted us to do this. So we said, okay. And we started in, I sat in on these negotiation sessions. At that time, Herman Badillo was there. From Manhattan, I think he was a senator.
Okay.
Robert Garcia from New York. what's the guy from Buffalo? Arthur Eve from Buffalo. There was, Bill Kunstler wasn't there at that time yet, but he was on the team. And Bobby Seale and a guy who was head of the National Panther Party, Young Lords, Puerto Rican, was coming.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a guy, Jim Ingram, from the Detroit Free Press, I think, was there. And so, you know, they started talking, and I may have mentioned to you about food, for example. And I was struck by the fact that outside of Rochester, there are a series of horse farms. Mm-hmm. And some of the places that those horses stay in are beautiful barns. I mean, they were prettier than the places where these prisoners were. And I thought, isn't it awful that we could treat, I mean, it's not that I had anything against the horses, bless their hearts, but that we could treat animals like that better than we can treat human beings. But anyway, this goes on and on. And that afternoon, we went into the courtyard. And Russell Oswald was the commissioner for prisons. Short, heavy-set man. Mm-hmm. And he was guarded, which naturally he would be. And Scotty and the negotiators were, you know, they had each had their sides, and he had his lieutenants with him. But we all went in there, and it was, you could cut the tension with a knife. I mean, here are these 1,500 or so prisoners, and this little negotiating team, and this state guy. And at one point, someone said that they told Oswald that he might not get out of there or something. We may keep you or something. And they said, no, we're not going to do that. Because he came in good faith and we're going to see that he stays. So this went on all afternoon. And I mean, you talk about draining. I just felt like, oh my God. At one point, they let us go by to see the hostages. And I remember speaking to an old man, a prison guard. He was a sergeant. And he said, well, do whatever you want, do whatever you can, because nobody wants to get killed. And there was he was Caucasian, there was another Caucasian young man there, young. And I didn't know him, but he said, you have to do whatever you can, please. And we only talked with him for like 15 seconds, and then we were back out there.
Describe to me how they're being held.
They were on the ground at this point, sitting there with their hands bound behind them. They didn't have a mask on at that point that I can remember.
And their hands are bound with clothing?
I don't know. They were behind them. I didn't look and see.
Okay. And so they're being held with knives, with shanks, with guns?
I didn't see anything. No, there was no gun. I never did see a gun.
Okay.
I didn't even see a knife at the time I was there. Mm-hmm. The whole time, I never saw a gun. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there were any. I don't think that they had any guns.
Well, they don't allow them behind the wall.
Right.
Right? But I'm not clear when that took effect, because Attica changed so many things in the state prison system.
Well, you know, there were claims that the prisoners shot the hostages.
Mm-hmm.
But there weren't any guns.
Right.
I never did see.
So are they holding them hostage then just by sheer numbers?
They
outnumber them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they were in this big courtyard, and there are thousands mm-hmm. of these prisoners and things. And these guys are, at least at that point when I saw them. And we went back to this table, negotiating table. And later that night, they had these barrels, 30-gallon drums, and they had fires in them. It was a weird-looking sight with these little fire things going. And at one point, it was real late. It was maybe 11 o'clock at night or something. I can't even remember. The time kind of merges. There were several times when they said they were coming in. There were rumors that they were coming. And all of a sudden, there was this big commotion, And they said, well, they're coming in. And those guys, these prisoners, put themselves between us and what they thought was coming in. And I thought, oh my Lord. And they had been, L.D. Barclay, who had given this impassioned speech in the afternoon, if we cannot live like men, at least we will not die like dogs. And he went on, and some of the words, had they been spoken anywhere else, would have been, you know, applauded.
They would have been immortalized.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Really.
Yeah.
But the thought that they would do that. And finally, about 4 o'clock in the morning or thereabouts, somebody arranged for us to leave. So we went out of that D courtyard. And in order to get out, you had to go through a little archway. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget this as long as I live. And this guy, I don't know how he lived through the thing, but he did. He died later. His name was Smith. And they called him Big Black. And as we started to go out, he said, Rev? I said, yes, sir. I didn't know his name. I just said, yes, sir. I said, yes, sir. He said, Rev, they're going to whip ass. But thank you so much for coming. And he hugged me. And I broke down in tears. I didn't let him know, but I just started crying. I couldn't stand it. So I got we got back to Rochester. And that was Saturday morning. And when we got back, it must have been 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning. And I was totally wiped out. And at that point, they had negotiated almost everything except for one point, and this was amnesty for the prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
And this DA, and according to New York State law, my understanding is, the DA was the only person who could grant amnesty, the district attorney of Wyoming County. So the prisoners said, I know the stories are that the prisoners refused to accept the responsibility for the thing. But the truth was, the prisoners said, well, look, choose one of us. We'll pick somebody. You choose one of us and you can indict that one. But how are you going to indict 1,500 people? Which made good sense. But he wouldn't do that. He indicted all 1,500 people for that. Guards dead. And that was the sticker. Everything had been negotiated out except that one point, amnesty. And so when we went home on Saturday morning, this was hanging over my head, and I thought about it. And I went to church, and when I got up, I was directing choir, and the minister asked me to give a report on Attica. And I stood up to give a report. I just was telling them about it, and all of a sudden, I just started to cry. I couldn't help it. And I just said, and I realized what was going on. I was going to go back. I didn't want to go back, and I was just, oh my God. So I said, I'm going back to Attica.
It's the problem with giving your life to God.
But it starts. And I keep saying, God, why are you? Come on, there are lots of people. So when I got home, I walked in the door. Portia said, you're going back, aren't you? And I said, yeah. And we got a phone call from a friend of ours, Clarence McKee. Clarence was an aide to Jake Javits. And so he called us from Washington saying that Javits was willing to call Attorney General Lefkowitz, who was going to lean on that DA down there in Wyoming County to see if he couldn't make him think about it. So I said, oh, that's good news. So I called Scotty. I said, Scotty, he says, well, just hold on. So I sat around there. About 4 o'clock, we got a phone call from Scotty, from Clarence Butch. And he was calling, and he said, it's no go. And I said, what do you mean, no go? He said, the decision has been made to go in. I said, well, who made the decision? And he said, high up. And I said, how high is high? And he said, as high as you can get. And of course, I said, you mean 1600 Pennsylvania? Because I'd been thinking about this. And he said, well, and that was it. And I thought, yeah. Because at Clarence, to this day, I ask him about that because I wanted to corroborate it. And he said, well, that's the way I recall it. And I put two and two together. There had been a disturbance in tombs down in Manhattan the year before. Angela Davis' lover, Jonathan Jackson, had tried to escape out at San Quentin the year before.
They accused him of trying to escape.
Well, yeah, well, they... I saw that picture with that judge, you know, they blew that judge's head off and killed him. And, I mean, he and this other guy killed the judge. But they died. The judge died, and they did too in that break. Mm-hmm. And anyway, I put those two together, and to this day, I believe that Richard Nixon and Nelson Rockefeller made a political decision to make an example out of Rochester, to Attica Prison, make sure that that didn't happen again around this country. Because all that foment that was taking place in prisons around the country.
Yeah.
So, when I went back, I said, well, Scott, I called Scott. And he said, well, we've got to go back. I said, yeah, I know. So we went back. And the attitude of the guards at the prison, it was markedly changed. They had been they had never been friendly, but they were at least polite. They were really angry and obnoxious when we went back. And I saw the courtyard was full, the yard where you go into the prison was full of shotgun boxes just on the ground. And I thought, oh my gosh. So we got in there, and Arthur Eve, Franklin was there by that time. Arthur Eve and all these guys were there. And some of them were crying. And there was a state senator named John Dunn. He was there. And he and I were desperately trying to see what we could do. And the guy, Jim Ingram, and one of the other negotiators was on the phone to Rockefeller, asking him to come down. So if you'd come down, this will defuse the situation. And he said he wasn't going to come down there and dignify these people. And so then some of the guys got mad at Russell Oswald, the negotiating committee. I'll never forget this as long as I can. His eyes were as red as that chair. And he said, I'm a man in hell. Don't you know I'm a man in hell tonight? And he knew that they were going to do this, I'm sure. But he was powerless to do anything about it. I felt, and to this day I feel, that Russell Oswald was a good man. And he was an enlightened, functionary in the prison system, wanted it to be better, was fighting against all kinds of things, realized that the conditions in the prisons were not the way they should be, but he was doing the best he could where he was to do something about it, I think. And I still think that. And I think in those negotiations, he recognized what was going on. And I felt, I never did talk to him. I never did ever sit down and have a conversation with him about it. John Dunn and I still sat there that night, actually laid there on the floor trying to think of some way we could break this thing. Mm-hmm. So, and it started raining. It was a miserable, kind of, it was like the whole sky was crying. And then in the morning, when we got up, a couple of the guys had gone out to a motel and they got back in. We don't know how they did, but they did. And they came in and said, man, those guards told us they were going to kill us for encouraging those prisoners to hang, to hold out. He said, oh my gosh, it's 2:30. So we said, well, you know, I don't know. I said, well, I'm not going to just sit up here and let somebody shoot me. So we started to put a file cabinet or something over the door and all that kind of stuff. But we were there. And he told us to leave the prison. And we said, well, we're not going out there with these guys, angry as they are. So they put us under house arrest. And we stayed there till 3 o'clock. at 9:06, just about that time, the clock stopped. And then we heard these helicopters come over. And I peeped out. Tom Wicker from the New York Times, Washington bureau, was there. And we peeped out there, and I could see guards firing into something. I couldn't tell. Later, they said that couldn't have been, because there was a courtyard between where we were in the administration office and the courtyard. But I said, no. Come to find out that the back of the chapel was exposed to that tower, and that 9 guys had gotten killed by guards in that tower.
You were put under house arrest to protect you from the correctional officers? Or from the guys in the prison?
I have no idea. Well, I just know that they put us under house arrest, and we didn't get out of there until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. And I saw them bringing out bodies, bringing out folks and just kind of putting them on the ground. And you could see that out from the other part of the office. It was pretty horrible. And when it was over and we went out, there were these 3,000, may not have been there, that many at that point, but they were certainly lined up all the way down the walk from the prison and from there to the gate. And I just came out of there and I thought, oh my gosh, Lord, please don't let me stumble. I don't know why, but that was my biggest concern. Don't let me stumble, because I didn't want to look defeated or weaker, because I felt terrible. And when we got out, they said there was a state trooper who was going to escort us back to Rochester, because the feelings were high in the town, of course. So Scotty got in the car and we took off, and this police officer escorted us to town, and we got outside of town and he waved us on, and then he turned around. Scotty floored it when we went back to Rochester.
And what was it like in Rochester when you got back there?
Well, you know, I just know that somebody called Scotty, you know, and said, kind of rough out there today, wasn't it? And poor Scotty was so upset. He threw his keys clear across the room. I'd never seen him this upset. He just broke down and cried. And but I was so wiped out, I barely knew my name at that. But then I went down to the TV station and gave an interview for the nightly news. I remember that. Then I went on back home and got in bed and couldn't sleep, of course, but late then. That was horrendous. You know what? I got to get you back to the
I know, no. I know
I got to get you ready to get it out of here.
Thank you so much.